Good morning. May it please the court, through me, the prisoners of Missouri send their greetings and their respect to this court. It's Valentine's Day, and we ask for return some love and mercy. There is a statute called MIRA, and the MIRA statute, you read it, first of all, has some constitutional problems. And I don't have enough time to literally list them all. I just ask you to read it. I'll point out the very first one, and that is that there, the statute says that an order, when this is initiated, an order may issue to show cause. Then further down in the statute, it says, and this is under section 217.835, it says that upon the filing of a complaint under subsection 1 of this section, the court shall issue an order to show cause why the prayer of the complainant shall not be granted. And if you go down to section 4 of the very same part, 217.835, it says, at a hearing on the complaint, an order before entering any order, it says before entering any order on behalf of the state against the defendant, the court shall take into consideration, and it has some factors, both legal and moral. That absolutely conflicts if you turn to section 217.837 that says to protect and maintain assets pending resolution of proceedings initiated pursuant to the provision of section 217, the court upon request may appoint a receivership. There are some real conflicts in the statute. That starts with. Additionally, in the statute, it talks about a hearing. In section 217.835, it says three times, at least in section 2, at least there has to be notice at least 30 days before the date of the hearing on the complaint and order. In section 3, at the time of the hearing on the complaint and order. At section 4, at the hearing on the complaint and order, and before entering any order. This seems to say that the statute mandates that there needs to be a hearing. We essentially have a summary judgment proceeding here. So there's some real contradictions in the statute. All I can ask is, together I would assume you folks have over 300 years experience in legal work. Sit down and read this carefully. There's some significant contradictions in this statute, which truthfully led to some of the problems. One of the problems is the assets. Mr. Peterson, we claim that this statute is vague according to his assets because his money was derived from a woodworking hobby. He became entrepreneurial in prison, and he was selling jewelry boxes and plaques and other items of woodworking that he made to other prisoners and their family, that should be exempt because under the section that gives you definitions of assets, which is 217.827, there's a whole section that excludes assets shall not include. And then it goes on to say money saved by the offender from wages and bonuses up to $2,500 paid to the offender while he or she was confined in the correctional center. So there's exceptions. First of all,
And how much over the whole time he'd been in the correctional center had he been paid?
Had he been paid in total? At about $600 in total, I believe.
$600 from selling his products.
He had collected, and this is where it gets very difficult to sort out. When this action was filed against him, he had $1,770
right.
In total. And that was what he had completely. Now, he's been in prison since 95, so there's numerous transactions back and forth. He would buy things, he would buy raw material, right. And sell finished product. But there's a question about the assets that needs to be looked at, because that's a problem. And also, it says here, money saved by the offender from wages and bonuses. What's bonuses? What is bonuses? Wages is pretty clear that when you're in prison, you get a state stipend. That's pretty clear. But what are bonuses? Who knows? I would submit to you that the money he was making from the woodworking hobby would fall within that. The other thing, too, about this statute is it has a particular harshness. It really does. It starts out with a show cause order to the prisoner to show cause why his money shouldn't be taken. And not just a little bit of his money, 90% of his money.
Isn't that when he could contest the probable cause determination from the Attorney General?
It's a good cause.
Well, Your Honor, I submit to you that that's exactly at the point that they get to do this. Now, the Attorney General is going to argue that they never get to challenge good cause,
yeah.
That the court can't review it, and it only comes under an administrative review under Section 536.150. So I would submit to you that there absolutely has to be good cause. And that's to blunt this harshness of the statute, because, I mean, what other procedure can you think of that starts out with a, you want my money, so I have to, you can get it, you can put it in the receivership, and I get a show cause order? That's a complete shift of the burden. The other thing, too, is this is a summary proceeding. I submit to you there has to be a hearing. There's a very significant mercy statute within this statutory scheme. If it's constitutional at all, this certainly should apply. And it's in a section 217.835.4. At the hearing on the complaint and order, and before entering any order on behalf of the state against the defendant, the court shall take into consideration any legal obligation of the defendant to support a spouse, minor children, or other dependents. And this is what's significant. And any moral obligation to support dependents to whom the defendant is providing or has in fact provided support. The judge, there's a mercy clause in here that the prisoner gets to go before the judge and say, look, judge, this is what I do with this money. And I submit to you that other dependents include themselves. That they can show support of themselves.
But were you not permitted to, I mean, was he not permitted to make these arguments to the judge? How did this proceed? There was a finding of good cause and then an order to show cause why his assets shouldn't be taken, and then what happened?
Well, first of all, I would correct you in that there was not a finding of good cause. There was a petition filed, which the other thing, too, is you have to ask yourself, this thing is so out of the ordinary, it might be in left field, and that maybe the legislature met some kind of special thing because they call this a complaint and it's not even a petition. But anyway, it started out with a petition. Mm-hmm. And then there was a finding of, there was an ex parte order, receivership established, and then a summary judgment proceeding. And that's it.
Well, you said there was an order asking you to show cause why your assets shouldn't be taken. Then what happened?
Well, then the prisoner responded with an answer.
So there was an opportunity to respond along the lines you're talking about?
Well, there definitely is an opportunity to respond, but the point is that what I'm saying is this statute says three times, a hearing, before the judge. So the reality is this prisoner should be brought in and have an opportunity to talk about this with the judge. Not just, folks, Your Honor, you got to understand, this is going to people in prison. By the time the order issues and it gets through the legal system, it's 2 weeks later, the poor prisoner has 2 weeks to respond, or he loses 90% of his money, which has already been yanked. Now he's down to how does he get postage, how does he get copies, how does he get legal help? And this thing is so one-sided, it's just not fair.
Now, when a prison comes up with regulations about safety there's not much requirement for substantive due process, but in this case, there's no rush to get his money. They can go through the processes to normal due process to allow the person to state their claim.
Well, I understand that, but at the same time, this is almost like a RICO action. First, you take their money. And
then I'm saying what you're saying. I'm saying this is getting people's money. This can take time. It's not a matter of the safety in the prison.
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. There is no rush to judgment here. I mean, there is no reason.
In the absence of a proceeding that in fact freezes or takes his assets, is there anything before this action was filed that would have prevented him from paying out the $1,700 to say, a family member or something like that? Does he have control of the money such as he could remove it from the prison?
He does have control of the money to the extent that if he wants to pay it out, what he has to do is get what they call a green check. He has to go to the Department of Corrections, ask for a green check, and he can write it out. So they're going to know that money's being dispersed. And the other thing, too, is that he can only do it in certain increments. And I apologize, different institutions have different levels, and different prisoners' classifications call for different levels. So it could be between $50 and $200.
So why should the state legislature be able to take away the person's constitutional rights to his money without due process of law?
Absolutely. This is a complete violation of due process.
Well, the question is, what process is due?
Well, first of all,
that's really where you are. I mean, you know, whether it seems unfair or seems harsh or unreasonable or something like that really isn't the issue. Right. And that is, the issue it seems to me that you're raising is he being deprived of property without the kind of due process that would be
It requires notice and an opportunity to be heard at meaningful time. And that's the key here. He's getting notice, but it's after the fact, and an opportunity to be heard at meaningful times. And what I'm saying is if you think the statute is constitutional at all, then you have to go back and say, this prisoner has to get an opportunity to be in front of this judge.
So you have two aspects to your argument. One is that, as written, it's unconstitutional because 30 days' notice is insufficient. And the second is that if that's not, it says on its face that he's entitled to a hearing, and he was not given an opportunity for a hearing in this case.
Exactly. Because summary judgment proceeding comes in and cuts that off. What I'm saying is,
summary judgment cuts off hearings in all sorts of cases.
Well, it does, but in most situations, you don't see three times in the statute where it says a hearing. Plus, you've got that mercy statute where he gets to plead the moral aspects of the case.
I understand, but you don't get a hearing if there are no facts that are contested.
Well, I absolutely agree, Your Honor. But what I'm saying in this particular case is, look, either we've got a due process problem. If you want to look at the statute and say it's okay, then you have to have the hearing to ensure due process. Or you have to say, look, this statute is not okay, and change it to some way that you could have some.
What if in response the prisoner said, you're right, I have $15,000 in my account, and it's all from wages? Would you still have to have a hearing?
Well, wages are exempt. So no.
Well, $2,500 are exempt. So.
No, you absolutely wouldn't. You absolutely wouldn't. But
So what happened here that required a hearing? Well, what did he say in response?
Well, I think what happened here was that they have to have, and I've got it down to 1 minute, and this is a difficult.
Please go ahead and answer the question. That's fine.
First of all, before the Attorney General can go into this entire action, they have to have a duty to investigate. Have to investigate. The statute gives them all kind of power. It gives them money. It gives them a super snoop provision where they can even ask the sentencing judge. They can inquire to the assets through the sentencing judge. And then they have to come, they have to make a determination about good cause. There's a safe harbor in the statute. It's a little bit complicated, but it's the lesser of 10% of 2 years of incarceration, or 10% of the total incarceration, or a stream of income that will pay this 10% within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a threshold. And in this case, my man doesn't even meet the threshold. Mr. Peterson has $1,770.
Did he respond to the order to show cause?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, what did he say in response?
He said, I only have $1,770. There's a part of the statute that allows prima facie evidence of the cost of incarceration, $14,000 a year. And so 10% would have been $2,800. He said, basically, you know, I'm $1,029 short. You cannot take my money.
The rules of when the Attorney General files a summary judgment, the rules of civil procedure kick in, so he could file a counter affidavit. And does he have access to a notary to do that?
Yes, and he did that in this particular case. But you have to understand, this prisoner is the exception. Most of these prisoners are simply getting defaulted in this situation.
Did the state respond to him to his affidavit saying you haven't met the 10% threshold?
It's probably best to ask him about the state, but honestly, no, they did not respond. They just simply said, we don't need to show that he actually had the money. We just have to believe that he does.
So there's a material fact. There's a dispute of material fact that would necessitate, in a normal case, a trial or a hearing.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the Western District yesterday, the case came down, and they remanded back to the trial court on this very point. Go find out what the good cause was. I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
What about the fact that there's a... I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, that's
what about the fact... What about the fact there's a material... that counter affidavit that says there's an issue of material fact that should be heard?
I don't believe there is an issue as a material fact. In fact, what he provided was... affidavits that showed from 1999 to 2007, he received $15,000 into his inmate account, and of that $15,000, $2,800 of it were from these woodworking projects. And I don't even believe that those were addressed in this briefing, because the issue that he raised was vagueness, not whether the court was correct in determining that these woodworking projects were or were not assets.
I think he raised all those things. In his briefs here, he certainly raised a number of constitutional and non-constitutional issues.
I'll accept Your Honor's...
assuming you did for the purposes of argument. Go ahead.
My reading of the brief is he's raised three challenges: a good cause challenge, a due process challenge, which was identical to the one addressed by the Western District in State X. Rel. Nixon versus Overmyer, and a vagueness challenge. And the primary reason why the state wanted this court to hear this case is because of clarification on the good cause as a defense to Myra. Because quite frankly, there's a great deal of confusion. Mr. George referred to State X. Rel. Nixon versus Houston, but there have been, in the last 4 weeks, there have actually been four cases come down from the Western District relating to good cause. And I believe that a review of those cases would show that the state, the inmates, and the courts, and the trial court don't necessarily understand the implications of the good cause. So we're here asking this court to give us a clear, what is the implication of the good cause?
When you file a petition, isn't your first paragraph that the Attorney General has conducted an investigation and determined that there is good cause to believe that he meets the threshold?
And the Attorney General does.
Is that the first paragraph of the petition?
It's in the petition. I'm not sure if that's in the, that's actually the first.
But you assert good cause.
You know what I mean.
Yes, when the Attorney General has, in his petition, says that there is good cause to believe that a sufficient amount will.
I say, so why can't the inmate file an answer denying that and have some kind of a factual determination on that question?
Well, and if that is what the court determines, then I would
ask. Is that what the statute?
Why wouldn't that be what we determine?
Isn't that what the statute requires?
Well, there is no provision under MIRA to address the good cause decision by the Attorney General.
I thought I heard Mr. George say that your office's position is that it doesn't matter whether it meets the 10% or not. It's what the Attorney General believes at the time he files the petition.
Well, and that is.
Is that your position?
That is getting into the good cause and skipping ahead in my argument. Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor.
But that's consistent with probable cause determinations of police officers in DWI cases.
Right. The only way you can determine good cause is looking at exactly what the Attorney General knew at the time.
Right.
A comparable statute is.
But here has their good cause if the information available to the Attorney General was not that he had 2,500, but 1,700 or whatever.
Well, and MIRA provides that not only that they have a certain threshold of assets, but whether they have a stream of income.
So okay, are you going on the stream of income in this case, or?
In this case, yes, it would be that the Attorney General had the good cause because this inmate has a stream of income.
You didn't go on stream of income in your petition, did you? I thought that was specifically not alleged in this case.
Actually, what was alleged in the petition was that the Attorney General has good cause to believe that he can recover a sufficient amount within 5 years.
Are you saying that can't be contested? I mean, for example, if someone has a default judgment taken against them, you have a right to have a good cause, good faith defense. If you have you have to have a good faith defense, but you can put evidence on in that regard and challenge it. You saying the Attorney General's determination of good cause is not challengeable?
Well, the question is what exactly does the good cause decision do? All the good cause decision does is yes, the Attorney
General. It's not a decision, it's an allegation by the Attorney General. You're saying it's a decision, it's not rebuttable?
I'm saying it is a decision by the Attorney General, and if there is a review of it, there's no specific review in MIRA. And so you would have to look at other provisions of the law to determine where that
is.
Well,
that's a condition preceding to you filing the complaint.
Yes. That making that decision is a condition precedent to filing.
So why is it as if it were an element of the things that you have to prove?
Well, is it an element that we have to prove for our prima facie case, or is it a defense? And that's part of the question
But either way, they get to litigate it, whether it's a defense or whether it's an element that you have to prove up.
Yes, and if this court determines that yes, indeed.
Well, so you agree with that one way or the other, they get to litigate it.
No, the question
whether
is,
it's a defense
did the Attorney General
it's
have good cause? The question is, can the court come in and review that good cause? I agree. It's a condition precedent. The estate has never disputed that it is a condition precedent to filing. The question is, can a court come in and come in and say no, the Attorney General didn't have good cause when the Attorney General
doesn't Martin Irv say that yes, you can, and absolutely that you can't just simply not thought that there's an obligation to follow your statutory duty and duties set out, and in that case, if you're going to find good cause to pursue a Human Rights Act violation, you first know probable cause, you first have to conduct an investigation, and Martin Irb said the person who's affected has a right to make sure that investigation was conducted because it's set out in the statute that you can't deny it until you conduct it. This certainly seems like a very comparable one, and I know you say you should then pursue it in a separate administrative proceeding, but Martin Irb was entirely an administrative proceeding, which this is also. I'm not clear why you're saying it should be divided into two administrative proceedings, this one and then some separate administrative appeal, when this is the only place it's relevant.
Well, I would argue that if there is review and the court does have review, the court has to look at what the Attorney General knew, what was in front of him, and the court can't just use its own discretion.
Well, but the standard for probable cause to believe is an objective standard. So it's not, did you personally believe you had, it's on the information before you, it's a reasonable person, was there probable cause to believe?
Yes,
so that is a standard that can be applied.
And it can only be what was before the Attorney General at the time. For example, there are some underlying cases where they used affidavits and discovery filed after the Attorney General.
So what was available to the Attorney General at the time? Assuming that one way or another they get to challenge this probable cause or good cause.
In this case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In this case, the Attorney General knew of regular deposits into the inmate account and, quite frankly, did not know where those deposits were originating.
Well, that doesn't matter where they're originating.
That's an interesting question because the statute requires a duty to investigate.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Sorry.
I'm not sure which answer.
Go ahead.
Can you please repeat?
There isn't just a responsibility to have a good cause, but there's a responsibility to investigate under the statute. So simply, if you choose not to investigate the source of that stream of income, is that, have you complied with the statute?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but if this case is remanded for a good cause hearing, I can tell you that the Attorney General will explain what databases they use, exactly what state agencies they ask for information, where they get the information, and all of that. None of that was addressed below, so if it
is... This money's deposited... Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Price, because I...
Excuse me, Judge Price.
But that money's deposited in your account, so somehow either a check or cash is put in your account, so it's a state's account. You know where the money comes from. At least you know some.
The state knows the person it came from. It does not necessarily know the ultimate source of those funds that go into that account. For example, we've had cases where a power of attorney is receiving income from annuities or income from pension retirement, and they're sending it in. All we know is that this person is sending $300 per month into the inmate account. And all of our investigations for the various state, the super snoop, as counsel states, is merely we can inquire at the state agencies. We have no power to inquire as to all the pension companies in the state. We have no power to inquire, to force that power of attorney to say exactly where they're getting that money, whether they're getting it from a pool of money in a bank account or whether they're getting it.
Well, as I read the Court of Appeals opinion in the briefs, for some reason, I thought that the only evidence in this case was that he had $1,700. And that was the only information available to the Attorney General at the time this complaint was filed to under what's Bureau.
Well, he had $1,700, but that originated, he received that amount in a certain period of time from deposits into his
account. Okay, well, let me ask you this. Would you agree that if all the evidence was that there was $1,700 in the account, that alone does not establish good cause?
In this case, because he's been for longer than 2 years, the good cause amount at the time of filing was approximately $2,800. So no, $1,700 alone would not have triggered Myra.
Okay.
And the Attorney General would not have filed.
But your position was there was $1,700 in regular deposits over 6 months, allowed the Attorney General to infer it would continue in regular deposits for a longer period?
That's what we alleged in the summary judgment.
Right.
And in fact, whenever
but you don't know what we don't know because there's been no hearing what the Attorney General thought at the time.
We know that the attorney, well, I can tell you.
Yeah. No,
attorney,
no, don't glass out the record, please.
So you're going under income stream. That's
yes.
What you would just
yes.
But
right.
What
happens
if he
had that
he might quit making these items? And how do you know he might not get hurt?
Quite honestly, the Attorney General had no idea that some of the income was from these projects. And in his summary judgment reply, as I said, from 1999 to 2007, he received $15,000 in deposits. Of that, he alleged $2,800 of it was from these woodworking projects.
And did
there's
we...
Been, there's, quite frankly, he's never said where all of the rest of it has come from.
Did the Attorney General have that information at the time he filed this petition, the $15,000?
The Attorney General was aware of the deposits into the inmate account, yes, because one of the databases that the Attorney General regularly looks at is, of course, the inmate account banking system.
One of the points here was that there was no allegation of stream of income. It was an allegation of assets. And not stream of income.
Well,
that's a big
was,
point made in the appellant's brief.
It was allegations of deposits into the inmate account, and in fact there was also an attachment to the petition of the inmate account showing those deposits into that inmate account.
So are you saying then that you got the trial court to give you summary judgment by convincing the trial court that this good cause prerequisite was not reviewable?
Actually, in this case,
how do you get summary judgment?
Well,
on what basis? I don't understand.
I'm glad you asked that so that I could address a little bit of that. What due process requires is a hearing. And it's been the state's position that, quite frankly, summary judgment and affidavit and having hearings on affidavits is actually more fair to inmates because they're not permitted to come to it. So therefore, the hearing itself was the court's review of the documents presented to the court.
Okay, what documents were presented to the court that justified summary judgment?
That he had $1,700 in his account, and that $1,700 came from a stream of income into his inmate account, a stream of deposits that made up income, because not all that money came from wages and salary.
Was there any evidence presented that there was a stream of income in the future? It has to be more than just a stream of income, doesn't it? I mean, you could have $5 a year for 50 years, and still wouldn't get to $2,500.
$5 a year for 50 years would of course not reach the $2,800.
You know what I mean.
Wouldn't you need to show some expectation of continued deposits in order to reach the approved stream of income?
Well, I think if you look at a document that shows from 1999 to 2007 that he received $15,000, that shows that he has at least in the past received regular deposits into his account, such that a reasonable person would believe that those deposits would continue into the future.
Let me ask you this: the purpose of this 10% provision, it seems to me, has very little to do with anything except maybe one thing. And that is the legislative judgment that reflects is that they don't want the Attorney General to be chasing after things that they can't get. And so you have to get to the 10% as a showing in order to go forward. Otherwise, you're wasting your own time and you're wasting the court's time.
And I agree, Your Honor, and that was addressed in Coons. They specifically said that the legislature didn't want the Attorney General doing that, and quite frankly, the money that goes into the MIRA program is from the money that comes in from this, because under 217.841, the Attorney General's office received 20% of the money that comes in. So if the money, if the Attorney General is chasing phantoms, there won't be any money to pursue the MIRA actions because there is no apportionment for the MIRA program.
That brings in something I wanted to clarify. If I understand, basically, whether or not there's a hearing on whether the good cause requirement was met, your position under the statute is that, say, once you meet that threshold, if you do, then good cause basically drops out, and how much money's in there drops out. You just get to recover assets. You get to recover 90% of the assets.
Yes, good cause relates.
It doesn't even matter if your good cause was correct, if you were correct.
Yes, Your Honor. Good cause relates to filing. It does not relate to ultimate recovery, and I believe this court addressed that in SADEX X Rel Nixon versus Powell.
So if we found there was good cause, or the record had showed there was good cause, and then whether you had $1,700 and no future income, you would still get to recover 90% of the $1,700 is the state's position.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But following up on Judge Limbaugh's question about good cause being a precedent, maybe that's intended to give the prisoner a little bit of due process in saying before you can file, you have to have a finding of good cause, but then as far as the trial goes, you still have to prove you're entitled to the money.
Right.
Well, the Western District hasn't ruled that way, good cause to file. And at that point, as the Western District has said in Coons, it was never the intention of the legislature to use some sort of a threshold to prevent the state from recovery. If at best it was to prevent the state from filing in the first place, so it's an attack of the petition, not an attack of the ultimate recovery.
Once you get past the good cause issue, what do you have to prove in order to recover?
At that point, assuming the state has good cause and the petition is not void, then what you would have to recover, you would have to prove that he has assets. In this case, even if he had no income coming in, he still would have $1,700 in assets.
What if those were all $2,500? I mean, you have to prove they weren't the first $2,500 in wages because he's allowed to keep those
well,
in account.
Well, and the state excludes
so
that because it's obvious from the
right.
Account
so you'd have
payment.
To prove that it's not that it's something that's recoverable.
Yes.
And was that done here? Was there some
shift? Yes, because the state specifically, and as did the court, specifically excluded wages and salary earned while incarcerated.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, your opponent indicates that there wouldn't be a possibility of a hearing, but I've known judges that go, and there's places where a judge could go into the prison and, for example, parole probation hearing, and at the hearing, if the statute requires a hearing, the judges can go to the court, go to the jail and or prison and have hearings.
Your Honors, I have to step back, because what's really going on here, Judge Wolf seemed to pick up on, and that is that this is, I call this the big fish statute. This was meant to go after big fish. Instead, we're chasing minnows. Every prisoner now in the system, they can take the data bank. You have to, first of all, they have to put their money with the Department of Corrections. So I can literally go to their computer, pull a data bank, and see how much is in these accounts and attach them. That's what's literally happening. The only information they had was that he had $1,770. I'm a little incensed that suddenly the Attorney General wants to switch over stream of income. Read their petition. This is what they said in paragraph 10. The Attorney General has good cause to believe that he will recover at least not less than either 10% of the estimated cost of care of the defendant or 10% of the cost of care for the defendant for 2 years, whichever amount is lesser through this action. There is not a word about stream of income because they had no idea what a stream of income was.
What about this $15,000?
You know, it's great to throw out a big number, boy. The problem is he's been incarcerated since 1995. And he gets a little bit of money from the family. He gets a little bit of support. What you have to look to is what's really in his account. I haven't done the math, but let's go back and pick out what the highs and lows were. The man never had $15,000. He never had more than $2,500. So what we're doing is we're suddenly taking this statute, and they want to make a cookie-cutter industry of this. We're just going to file blanket petitions. We're going to go down for summary judgment, and we're going to take this money. It makes great politics in a political year, but it's wrong. Because the statute says, look, there's speed bumps. You've got to stop here. You have to give due process. You have to do all kinds of things.
What if they earn Social Security prior to being in prison, and they're 65 and they're getting paid their Social Security, and it goes to the account? I mean, under Philpott, they can't collect. No one can collect the Social Security.
Well, Your Honor, that's not.
That's the source of the funds.
Right. That could be the source of funds. And if you look at the statute, that's attachable. That is attachable. This statute goes after everything. And what's really significant here, and if you look at the legal file and look at the affidavits, these were gifts. By and large, these were gifts. And there's some real practical effects to this statute. If you allow this to go through, essentially you're making everybody who sends $10 to their loved one in prison pay a 90% gift tax. There won't be any money coming in.
When this was filed, I mean, how did it come to summary judgment? I suppose they attached an affidavit and a motion for summary judgment. Did you respond, and how?
Your Honor, regretfully, I came into this case after the appellate level.
Well, okay.
He was pro se, and
well, what happened?
I didn't handle it. Well, what basically happened was is that he first of all raised constitutional arguments, etc., and then replied to summary judgment, and it was granted.
Did the client file any response?
He filed affidavits that the money was gifts. He filed an affidavit himself, where the money came from. He filed an affidavit saying that he didn't have didn't meet the minimum of $2,800.
Why is it just a direct appeal of that summary judgment determination the way to go?
Your Honor, had I been involved in the case, it would have been substantially different.
I'm limited to work with what is here.
The prisoner handled this himself through the Western District.
Thank you.
Sounds like the prisoner did a pretty decent job.
You know, there is a particular prisoner who remained unmentioned who probably has more appellate decisions than I do that helped foster this. And if I could reveal his name, he'd probably be transferred immediately from the Department of Corrections to another facility.
Can I ask just a quick question? Do you agree that once we get past the good cause issue, whether a hearing or however we do, then it's simply a question of does he have assets that are attachable? Good cause drops out at that point?
No, I think at that point, no, good cause.
And percents and so forth drop out?
But this is what's significant.
Does the 10% drop out at that point? If we decide that he had good cause to believe there was a stream of income or he had 10% of the cost,
that becomes a threshold. That's what it takes to establish jurisdiction.
Once you do that, then what are the issues?
Well, then the issues are, is there a stream of income, and what are the facts around that? And secondly, does he actually have money to meet this minimum standard?
Well, what's the minimum standard? Because opposing counsel says once you pass the threshold, there is no minimum standard, then if you have good cause to believe there's 10%. You don't actually have to have 10%. The statute doesn't seem to require that.
That's the thing about the statute. That's true. You don't have to have the 10%. What I would say is kind of, how it's odd that you would have a threshold of 10% and then nothing. So, in other words, if you can't meet that 10%, you don't even get into court. And that was the point. And what's really significant is the Attorney General here, they're asking you, listen, nobody look at the good cause. Nobody can review it. They don't want the court to review it. They don't want the prisoner to be able to challenge it as an affirmative defense or a counterclaim or anything. They just want to say, look, we believe this. That's it. And we go forward. And that's not enough.
And what do you think about opposing counsel's argument that the hearing really can be on the affidavits and answer and does not intend a hearing in person? And logistically, would it be feasible to give in-person hearings in all those cases?
You know what? Sometimes you just have to ask the people who are being affected by this. I promise you, these prisoners want their day in court. They don't want to be stripped of their assets. Frankly, folks, they have very little. And we're taking it away from them.
Yeah, but if there's no facts and controversy after affidavits, competing affidavits are filed, then summary judgment is appropriate, and they don't get out of jail free card.
Your Honor, I would agree with that, except I would say this. If they're going to plead stream of income, then absolutely there has to be a hearing, because that's always can be argued.
There doesn't have to be a hearing if there's no response filed, or if there is a response, they don't deny that there is a stream of income. Summary judgment's appropriate then.
Well, but at the same time, remember the mercy clause. They get to come in and talk about why they have an opportunity to not have the money taken away.
Okay. Thank you.
Is the term wages defined in the statute?
No. Your Honors, in my last few seconds here, I'm going to tell you there's some very practical considerations. There's an economy within the prison, and they spend their money buying pizzas and candies and supporting the chapel and the library and the recreation facilities and the AA meetings. And if you take away the little bit they have through this attack on the prisoners, that will collapse.
They charge them for AA meetings?
No. The AA groups sell money, or sell pizzas and candy to raise money for the meetings. I don't know exactly, I haven't been incarcerated, I don't know exactly how it works, but I know that there's an economy system there, that this is very disruptive to you, that chills gifts.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.